Namaste. So, it's a great chapter, The Divine Worker. We reached about the midpoint, as we typically do after one section of reading. Let's continue and recognize that in Sri Aurobindo's treatment of the Gita here, we're making a transition here from the fourth to the fifth chapter of the Gita in his commentary. The fourth is Jnana Karma Sannyasa Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, works, and renunciation. And now we're moving more and more into the fifth chapter, which is about sannyasa. But what is the real meaning of sannyasa yoga? Arjuna, still in the ignorance, may feel in his heart the call of right and justice, and may argue in his mind that abstention from battle would be a sin entailing responsibility for all the suffering that injustice and oppression and the evil karma of the triumph of wrong bring upon men and nations. Or he may feel in his heart the recoil from violence and slaughter, and argue in his mind that all shedding of blood is a sin which nothing can justify. We've seen this opposition in earlier pages. Indeed, it sets the field, the Kurukshetra, doesn't it, for Arjuna, who wants to quit and run away from the horror of war. And Krishna has to remind him of his place in the cosmos and what really is at stake in the maintenance of Sanatana Dharma. And here we are again in the thick of it. This is what the divine worker is about. You have to live spiritually to be able to act spiritually. You have to know the divine to have knowledge of anything, really, because the rest of it is, oh, it's a shambling semblance of reality. So Sri Aurobindo continues, both of these attitudes would appeal with equal right to virtue and reason, and it would depend upon the man, the circumstances, and the time, which of these might prevail in his mind or before the eyes of the world. Or he might simply feel constrained by his heart and his honor to support his friends against his enemies, the cause of the good and just against the cause of the evil and oppressive. Well, remember the scene at Kurukshetra. There are many, many thousands of warriors there. And those who are fighting on the side of Duryodhana know that he's wrong. Many of them see clearly that he's wrong in his aim and his method, and that he is acting in a way that is anti-dharma. And yet they feel bound by obligation, by kinship, by pledge of loyalty to continue to support him, even when he is wrong. But none of this has any relevance to the spiritual insight. Sri Aurobindo says, the liberated soul looks beyond these conflicting standards. He sees simply what the Supreme Self demands from him as needful for the maintenance or for the bringing forward of the evolving Dharma. He has no personal ends to serve, no personal loves and hatreds to satisfy, no rigidly fixed standard of action which opposes its rock line to the flexible advancing march of the progress of the human race, or stands up defiant against the call of the infinite. He has no personal enemies to be conquered or slain, but sees only men who have been brought up against him by circumstances and the will in things to help by their opposition the march of destiny. worth pausing there. So even those who are errorful are helpful to the larger mission. Against them, he can have no wrath or hatred, for wrath and hatred are foreign to the divine nature. And what we've seen here is a description not of ethical compass, but of inner reality. The divine worker is described, defined by inner poise. The asura's desire to break and slay what opposes him, the rakshasa's grim lust of slaughter, are impossible to his calm and peace, and his all-embracing sympathy and understanding. He has no wish to injure, but on the contrary, a universal friendliness and compassion. Maitraha karuna evacha. That's 12:13. But this compassion is that of a divine soul overlooking men, embracing all of the souls in himself, not the shrinking of the heart and the nerves and the flesh, which is the ordinary human form of pity, nor does he attach a supreme importance to the life of the body, but looks beyond to the life of the soul and attaches to the other only an instrumental value. So seeing within, perhaps even with the depth, to recognize what that soul intends to achieve and why it must adopt this particular disguise of the moment and act the way it does, and not judge it, but still act in a way that fulfills one's own dharma, one's own service to the divine. A very important point. And the life of the body, it's of instrumental use. It's an instrument. It will be replaced. And the dissolution of the body is not the dissolution of the being of the soul. Go back to chapter 2, chapter 3, where Sri Aurobindo points out the lines of immortality that the Gita first assuages Arjuna's heart with. He's troubled that he has to kill all of these people, but you cannot slay them. They are immortal by definition. The form goes, but it is I, the divine, who has slain them, not you, Arjuna. You are the instrument of the occasion. He will not hasten to slaughter and strife, but if war comes in the wave of the Dharma, he will accept it with a large equality and a perfect understanding and sympathy for those whose power and pleasure of domination he has to break, and whose joy of triumphant life he has to destroy. So the Rakshasa and the Asura glory in their victory and want dominion over all. And calmly and without hatred, here comes the divine warrior, the divine worker, to put down that darkness, to put down that aberration. Whether it's in the field of battle or whether it's in the field of business, one has often to act in a way that supports the motion forward of the race. Not staying put in the gratification of the senses and the vain attempt to satisfy desire. For in all things, he sees two things. The divine inhabiting every being equally, the varying manifestation unequal only in its temporary circumstances. In the animal and man, in the dog, the unclean outcast, and the learned and virtuous Brahman, in the saint and the sinner, in the indifferent and the friendly and the hostile, in those who love him and benefit, and those who hate him and afflict. He sees himself. He sees God, and has at heart for all the same equal kindliness, the same divine affection. Chapter 5, Shloka 18. Circumstances may determine the outward clasp or the outward conflict, but can never affect his equal eye, his open heart, his inner embrace of all. And in all his actions, there will be the same principle of soul, a perfect equality, and at the same principle, pardon me, and the same principle of work, the will of the divine in him, active for the need of the race in its gradually developing advance towards the Godhead. So, Purusha, the will of the divine, Anumanta, and the equality, Samatva, or Samata. Again, the sign of the divine worker is that which is central to the divine consciousness itself, a perfect inner joy and peace, which depends upon nothing in the world for its source or its continuance. It is innate. It is the very stuff of the soul's consciousness. It is the very nature of divine being. The ordinary man depends upon outward things for his happiness. Therefore, he has desire. Therefore, he has anger and passion, pleasure and pain, joy and grief. Therefore, he measures all things in the balance of good fortune and evil fortune. None of these things can affect the divine soul. It is ever satisfied without any kind of dependence. Nitya tripto nirashrayaha. 4:20. For its delight, its divine ease, its happiness, its glad light are eternal within, ingrained in itself. Atmaratihi antasukha antar aramas Tatantar Jyotir Evayaha. That's 5:24. What joy it takes in outward things is not for their sake, not for things which it seeks in them and can miss, but for the self in them, for their expression of the divine, for that which is eternal in them and which it cannot miss. So, the essence, the eternal, the true, as opposed to the transient and the apparent. It is without attachment to their outward touches, but finds everywhere the same joy that it finds in itself, because its self is theirs. Has become one self with the self of all beings, because it is united with the one and equal Brahman in them through all their differences. Brahma Yoga Yuktatma Sara Bhutatma Bhutatma. That's 5:21 and then 5:7. It does not rejoice in the touches of the pleasant, or feel anguish in the touches of the unpleasant. Neither the wounds of things, nor the wounds of friends, nor the wounds of enemies can disturb the firmness of its out-gazing mind or bewilder its receiving heart. This soul is in its nature, as the Upanishad puts it, avranam, without wound or scar. That's Isha Upanishad 8. in all things. It has the same imperishable ananda. Sukam akshayam ashnute. 521. It means literally, enjoys endless felicity. That equality, impersonality, peace, joy, freedom, do not depend on so outward a thing as doing or not doing works. The Gita insists repeatedly on the difference between the inward and the outward renunciation, tyaga and sannyasa. We go forward to chapter 18, shloka 2 for that. The latter, sannyasa, it says, is valueless without the former, hardly possible even to attain without it, and unnecessary when there is the inward freedom. When you don't grasp, then the outward renunciation isn't necessary. When you don't think you possess, then you don't have to renounce possession, you see. He should be known. Oh. In fact, tyaga itself is the real and sufficient sannyasa. He should be known as the eternal sannyasin who neither hates nor desires. That's 5.3. Free from the dualities, he is happily and easily released from all bondage. The painful process of outward sannyasa, dukkham aptum, is an unnecessary process. That's 5.6. Dukkham aptum means hard to attain. Attained by suffering. It is perfectly true that all actions, as well as the fruit of action, have to be given up to be renounced, but inwardly, not outwardly, not into the inertia of nature, but to the Lord in sacrifice, into the calm and joy of the impersonal from whom all action proceeds without disturbing his peace, as we see in the image of Nataraj. The true sannyasa of action is the reposing of all works on the Brahman. He who, having abandoned attachment, acts reposing or founding his works on the Brahman, Brahmani adhaya karmani, is not stained by sin, even as water clings not to the lotus leaf. Chapter 5, Shloka 10. Therefore, the yogins first do works with the body, mind, understanding, or even merely with the organs of action, abandoning attachment for self-purification. Sangam tyaktva atma shuddhaya. That's essentially that. This is from 5.11 through 5.13. By abandoning attachment to the fruits of works, the soul, in union with Brahman, attains to peace of rapt foundation in Brahman. But the soul not in union is attached to the fruit and bound by the action of desire. The foundation, the purity, the peace once attained, the embodied soul perfectly controlling its nature, having renounced all its actions by the mind, inwardly, not outwardly, sits in its nine-gated city, neither doing nor causing to be done. For this soul is the one impersonal soul in all. The all-pervading Lord, Prabhu, Vibhu, who, as the impersonal, neither creates the works of the world, nor the mind's idea of being the doer, nakartravam nakarmani, nor the coupling of works to their fruits, the chain of cause and effect. This is a section in the fifth chapter, 14 and 15. I'm not going to get this right. Nakartritvam means not agency. Nakarmani means not action. So neither the doer nor what is done. All that is worked out by the nature in the man. Swabhava, his principle of self-becoming, as the word literally means. So swabhava expresses the inner values of the individual's soul. Swadharma is the form that it takes in the external missioning. The all-pervading impersonal accepts neither the sin nor the virtue of any. These are things created by the ignorance in the creature, by his egoism of the doer, by his ignorance of his highest self, by his involution in the operations of nature. And when the self-knowledge within him is released from this dark envelope, that knowledge lights up like a sun, the real self within him. He knows himself then to be the soul supreme above the instruments of nature. Pure, infinite, inviolable, immutable, he is no longer affected. No longer does he imagine himself to be modified by her workings. By complete identification with the impersonal, he can, too, release himself from the necessity of returning by birth into her movement. The ideal is not to be compelled, not that one must abandon action in the world, but one wants to be released from the compulsion to act according to ignorance. That's the moksha we aspire for. And yet, this liberation does not at all prevent him from acting. Only, he knows that it is not he who is active, but the modes, the qualities of nature, her triple gunas. The man who knows the principles of things thinks, his mind in yoga with the inactive impersonal, I am doing nothing. When he sees, hears, touches, smells, eats, moves, sleeps, breathes, speaks, takes, ejects, opens his eyes or closes them, he holds that it is only the senses acting upon the objects of the senses. That's this fifth chapter again, shlokas 8 and 9. Because the purusha is not identified with the prakritic elements in the front. The soul is not the form that it uses for expression in the world. It maintains a difference even when it fuses with it to act in increasing light. He himself, safe in the immutable, unmodified soul, is beyond the grip of the three gunas, three gunatita. He is neither sattvic, rajasic, nor tamasic. He sees with a clear, untroubled spirit the alternations of the natural modes and qualities in his action, their rhythmic play of light and happiness, activity and force, rest and inertia. This superiority of the calm soul, observing its action but not involved in it, this trigunatitya, is also a high sign of the divine worker. By itself, the idea might lead to a doctrine of the mechanical determinism of nature and the perfect aloofness and irresponsibility of the soul, but the Gita effectively avoids this fault of an insufficient thought by its illuminating super-theistic idea of the Purushottama. In other words, there would be a divorce between Purusha, the witness soul, and nature, Prakriti, what fuses them together and makes them inseparably one reality is the presence of the Supreme Being himself, the Purushottama, the Supreme Person. Super theistic because it's beyond the idea of the typical God, the God of rain, the God of fire, whichever God you're talking about, the God of lightning, the God of mind. The Purushottama is beyond all these trifles and is that from which all things come, including Atman and Brahman, the separable powers of Purusha and Prakriti. All things are incidents, manifestations, aspects, attributes of this indescribably unique being, who nevertheless, despite that uniqueness, indwells everything. So, equality, samatha, is real. Whatever you gaze upon, whatever you regard, is the same soul as yourself. It makes it clear, in other words, the Gita makes it clear that it is not, in the end, nature which mechanically determines its own action. It is the will of the Supreme which inspires her. He who has already slain the Dhritarashtrians, he of whom Arjuna is only the human instrument, a universal soul, a transcendent Godhead, is the master of her labor. The reposing of works in the impersonal is a means of getting rid of the personal egoism of the doer, but the end is to give up all our actions to that great Lord of all, Sarva Loka Maheshwara, with a consciousness identified with the self. Renouncing all thy actions into me, mayi sarvani karmani sannyasa sannyasya adhyatma chetasa, freed from personal hopes and desires, from the thought of I and mine, delivered from the fever of the soul, fight, work, do my will in the world. So this goes back to chapter 3, shloka 30. Maya sarvani karmani, all actions in me. The divine motives, inspires, determines the entire action. The human soul, impersonal in the Brahman, is the pure and silent channel of his power. That power in the nature executes the divine movement. So we use this realization of Atman, of Brahman, to become free of all confusions so that we can then return as a universalized, equal spirit and act efficiently and beautifully and purely in ways that demonstrate the divine will here and now. Such only are the works of the liberated soul. Muktasya Karma, 423. For in nothing does he act from a personal inception. Such are the actions of the accomplished Karma Yogin. They rise from a free spirit and disappear without modifying it, like waves that rise and disappear on the surface of conscious, immutable depths. Gata sangasya muktasya jnana vastita chetasa yajnaya charata karma samagram praviliyate. That's again 423, translated in English. It says, more or less literally, when one is liberated from attachment and free, whose mind is established in knowledge and acts in offering, all his karma is dissolved. So in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo has been bringing us to recognize that, again, the divine worker acts always, acts from truth, acts without desire, acts without reference to ego, acts based in a broad universal equality. And it is to equality that we turn next when we get to the 19th chapter. So that we take up next week. Now, to close this session, I thought I'd read from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings in Savitri. This is in Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release, and we'll start towards the bottom of page 24. Original and supernal immanence, of which all nature's process is the art, the cosmic worker set his secret hand to turn this frail mud engine to heaven use. A presence wrought behind the ambiguous screen. It beat his soil to bear a titan's weight, refining half-hewn blocks of natural strength. It built his soul into a statued god. The craftsman of the magic stuff of self, who labors at his high and difficult plan in the wide workshop of the wonderful world, modeled in inward time his rhythmic parts. Then came the abrupt transcendent miracle. The masked immaculate grandeur could outline, at travail in the occult womb of life, his dreamed magnificence of things to be. A crown of the architecture of the worlds, a mystery of married earth and heaven, annexed divinity to the mortal scheme. A seer was born, a shining guest of time. For him, mind's limiting firmament seized above. In the griffin forefront of the night and day, a gap was rent in the all-concealing vault. The conscious ends of being went rolling back. The landmarks of the little person fell. The island ego joined its continent. Overpassed was this world of rigid, limiting forms. Life's barriers opened into the unknown. Abolished were conceptions, covenants, and striking off subjection's rigorous claws, annulled the soul's treaty with nature's nescience. All the gray inhibitions were torn off and broken the intellect's hard and lustrous lid. Truth unpartitioned found immense sky room. An empyrean vision saw and knew. The bounded mind became a boundless light. The finite self mated with infinity. His march now soared into an eagle's flight, out of apprenticeship to ignorance. Wisdom upraised him to her master craft, and made him an archmason of the soul, a builder of the immortal secret house, an aspirant to supernal timelessness. Freedom and empire call to him from on high. Above mind's twilight and life's star-led night, there gleamed the dawn of a spiritual day. So there we are. Good to see you, those of you whom I can see. Much love to you all, seen or unseen. And I look forward to seeing you again later or being with you in some measure in some way. Namaste. Jai Ma.